Welcome to another edition of the Prophecy Update radio program, whereby we intend to authenticate the sovereignty of God through Bible prophecy by telling you what Bible prophecy has to say about these last days. Seemingly, Israel's very existence is under severe threat. Ahmadinejad of Iran wants to wipe the Jewish state off of the map and is about to have the nuclear wherewithal to accomplish this dastardly deed. Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah, recently said, Hezbollah can wipe out one half of Israel's army. Worldwide anti-Semitism seems to be increasingly on the rise, and even America seems to be turning its back on our old best friend, Israel. Now, what does this all mean? Where is this all headed prophetically? Will Israel be wiped off of the map to cease to exist? And if so, what does that say about the covenant-making character of the God of Abraham who promised the eternal existence of his people, the Jews? Lastly, what is replacement theology, and why does it seem to be on the rise, spiraling out of control in the Christian church today? I'm going to be discussing these topics and many more with our guest on Prophecy Update, Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum. Arnold, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Arnold, Romans 1:16 makes it pretty clear, if I'm not mistaken. It says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first and also for the Greek." Can you give us your interpretation of what that's saying?
Well, just take it as a reads. Whenever the gospel goes out, in whatever means it goes out to a Jew first. There's only one verb that controls the last two clauses. Only one verb. The verb is the verb is, Greek present tense. The Greek present tense emphasizes continuous action. So it teaches that the gospel is continuously God's power to save, and therefore continuously the Jew first, also Greek. If we try to reinterpret it in the sense that it used to be the Jew first, but no longer, the verse would then have to also be interpreted to teach that the gospel used to be God's power to save, but no longer. But the gospel is always God's power to save, it's also always the Jew first, and also Greek, which obligates any evangelistic ministry that begins to reach out to a specific segment of the community, whether it's a church outreach or a mission outreach or something else. They must seek out the Jewish neighborhood first and evangelize it, and then move on to the Gentile side of the community.
And there's an abundance of precedence for this through Paul, correct?
If one simply looks at Paul's activities, and keep in mind he was the apostle to the Gentiles, that was his calling, he's always careful to fulfill Romans 1:16. So from the time he goes on his ministry in Acts 13, until the last phrase found in Acts 28, he consistently goes out to the Jew first. Even after he's been to one city, then comes back to the city again, as we see in chapters 18 and 19. He was in Ephesus, proclaimed the gospel of Jew first. He left Ephesus, came back to Ephesus, he again went to the Jew first. So whether he went only once or multiple times, he was always careful to fulfill Romans 1:16 to the Jew first.
Now, I recall once upon a time, you were doing a presentation that actually you had found a way that the Palestinians could actually bring Israel to extinction. And there's only one way that can happen. Do you remember? What is that way that could be accomplished?
Yeah, the message was entitled, How to Destroy the Jews. Because Israel as a state might cease to exist as it ceased to exist before, but Jewish continuity continued. And the passage is in Jeremiah 31, verses 35 through 37, which says, if you can destroy the sun, moon, and stars, then God will cease his mercy to Israel, and Israel will cease to exist. So Ahmadinejad and others will need to first destroy the sun, moon, and stars. Once they've done that, God promises he'll allow the Jews to be destroyed, but not before then. And so that's the priority they should give, a priority they'll never be able to achieve.
Well, I don't think he's developing that kind of weapon. That's not going to quite reach that far, is it?
Well, he might be foolish enough to try.
You know, I went to a prophecy conference. I was telling you, Arnold, about this. When I first became a Christian, we were very excited about Bible prophecy. And I was anxious to hear you talk about some cutting-edge Ezekiel 38, whatever it was going to be. And I went there and I got a good dose of the Abrahamic covenant, and I left there more blessed than I could have ever imagined. And you know, I think Christians really need to know what's behind this Abrahamic covenant and why it is so critical, because the church is totally disconnected from the Abrahamic covenant with respect to replacement theology and God's plan for Israel and the Jew. Can you take a moment to talk about that and how critical that is for the church to understand that that covenant is still effectually in place?
Well, the Abrahamic covenant is clearly an unconditional covenant. You see that by the way the covenant is signed in Genesis chapter 15. And normally when two people made a blood covenant, the greater terms of it, then they would kill one or more animals by shedding blood, divide the animals in half, and both men making the covenant walked between the animal pieces. And both of them walked between them, it rendered the covenant conditional. What they were saying is, may my blood be shed as this animal blood was shed if I don't keep the terms of the covenant. And if one failed to fulfill it and gave up his life, it would then free the other one from fulfilling his obligations. But Genesis chapter 15, God follows the basic procedure. Animals are killed by shedding blood, divided in half, and lined up in rows. It was not God and Abraham that together walked between the animal pieces. God puts Abraham into a deep sleep, a visionary sleep, because Abraham is conscious of what happens. And God, in visible form, in the form of the Shekhinah, the Shekinah glory alone, walks between the beasts and the animals. And by walking alone, he renders the covenant unconditional, which means no matter how often Adam will fail, and he'll fail in the very next chapter, chapter 16, he cannot render the covenant null and void. No matter how often his descendants fail, he cannot render the covenant null and void. And there are 15 provisions in the covenant. The one I emphasized in that message was the principle of God will bless them that bless you, he will curse them that curse you. And I gave a historical overview of any nation or individual that's raised their hand against the Jew has fallen. And the same principles in prophecy. And we see the same principle that when they come against the Jews, God will intervene. And so that reason, replacement theology is just dead wrong, because it assumes that God replaced Israel in the covenantal standing. That's not something God can do in an unconditional covenant. It would violate God's own ethic and promise. And so when Paul talks about the church's relationship to the covenants, he doesn't say the church has become a taker-over, but rather a partaker, and the church partakes of the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants, but does not partake of the physical promises and blessings like the promise of the land. And so there's been no replacement. That's wishful thinking and not exegetically true.
What are you seeing on the prophetic radar screen that you suggest people should be watching? Certain stage setting events and things like that that we should be considering, that some prophecies may be about to be fulfilled, and which prophecies might those be?
Well, there's three different elements in Israel now shooting, moving towards the refilling of the Jewish temple. One group is called the Temple Mount Institute, who are making all the furnishings for the temple. They've got most of the furnishings ready. Then there's a second group called the Teret HaKohanim, the crown of the priesthood, which are training the descendants of Aaron to do proper sacrifices. And the third group are trying to produce the perfect red heifer, which is needed to cleanse the men who work with the priesthood before they enter the temple compound. So these three things are happening simultaneously, and that's a watchful thing. And then when I wrote my first prophecy book, the Shah was in charge of Iran. Iran was quite pro-Israel, but things have changed radically, which is what the Bible said would happen. And from radical to very radical, to a point they want to invent the nuclear bomb, just destroy Israel, that's the whole goal. But that's in keeping with the Ezekiel prophecy in chapters 8 and 39, so there's something else you can look for. I'm very careful to warn people not to do too much newspaper exegesis, and these are just basically things to observe. Whether that's actually going to do it right now or not, only time will tell. So no need to scare people. Let's wait and see what happens.
Okay, and the other thing too, speaking of the temple, you know, we know there'll be a temple because we're told, give us a couple temple references why we know there will be a temple.
Well, the temple mentioned for the tribulation is mentioned in Daniel 9:27. It's mentioned in Daniel chapter 12, verses 11 through 13. It's mentioned in Isaiah chapter 66, verses 1 through 4. It's mentioned in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 and 7. And it's mentioned in Revelation 11, verse 1 and 2, among others. All these passages clearly speak of a tribulation temple that will be functioning in the tribulation and finally become the worship headquarters for the Antichrist.
So the groups you're talking about that are making these preparations would seem to find a very logical connection with this very temple, prophetic
exactly.
temple you're talking about.
That's the temple I'm talking about.
Okay, now, do you believe with respects to Psalm 83, and I'm not going to talk about timing per se, but do you believe that the God is going to empower perhaps the Israeli Defense Forces to deal with that episode? I cite passages that you've got in your Footsteps of Messiah. I think it's Ezekiel 25:14 and Obadiah 1:18. It seems to be that God deals with that issue perhaps through empowering the Israeli military. Is that a safe assumption?
Yeah, I think there's a certain segment of Psalm 83 was seen fulfilled already in the two wars where all those territories were involved. That includes the War of Independence in 1948 and the Six-Day War in 1967, but there's more to come yet in that psalm. But God will definitely empower the Israeli army to withstand. The modern Jewish state is safe until the midpoint of the tribulation. At the midpoint, there'll be a collapse. The government will be taken over by the force of the Antichrist. There'll be one more exile from the land, a short exile limited to 3.5 years, only in the Middle East area. But that next exile will bring the national repentance, and then we'll finally see the final regathering of faith and preparation of blessings of the kingdom. But the Bible speaks only two worldwide regatherings. The first was the one we see now. And so no matter what threats happening to Israel, no matter how many are attacked, they'll survive as a nation until the midpoint of the tribulation. Only then will the collapse come.
And why will they survive as a nation? How do we know they'll survive as a nation?
But they are a nation now, and they won't lose their sovereignty as a nation until the midpoint of the tribulation. Mm-hmm. Once the invasion occurs at the midpoint, the Antichrist takes over Jerusalem, the Jewish people are fleeing Jerusalem, they're fleeing the land, they're fleeing to territories outside, they've forced the land, mostly in the area of Jordan, and so on. And so there won't be an Israeli government at that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And the city and the temple are both controlled by the Antichrist, and he will set up his image from within the Holy of Holies of the Jewish temple. So I think there's a clear indication Israel will lose its sovereignty. But between now and then, as a state, they'll survive. Doesn't mean they'll survive all the territory. They've given up territory already. They may give up some more territory. That part we have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. But as a state, they'll survive all the way to the midpoint.
And, you know, getting back to the way God deals with Psalm 83 by empowering the Israeli military. Unlike that episode, he deals with Ezekiel 38 and 39 through, he stops that through divine destruction.
Right.
So, now in both episodes, the response, it appears to be, of the Jewish people in Israel is to regress towards, certainly many people will probably come to the Lord through Messiah, believe in Messiah. Jews. However, it does appear, and thus the need for the third temple, that they're going to gravitate back toward the reinstatement of the Mosaic Law.
Yeah, and when you go back into Orthodox Judaism, that's what you go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And Ezekiel 38 to me is a pre-trib event anyway, so that doesn't affect what happens within the tribulation. That's why Israel will survive that invasion.
Now, speaking of that, you believe Ezekiel 38 is a pre-tribulation event. And there's all kinds of discussions as to whether it is or not. And I think you have one of the more solid reasons as to why you believe that. And I concur with that. Now, what is that reason why you believe it's a pre-trib event?
Well, the key element is the fact of the 7 months of burial and the 7 years of burning of equipment. And therefore, you got to figure take in those 7 years, and many of the other views on the timing ignore that issue. But, well, we know again the Jewish people are fleeing the land In fact, Jesus says they won't even have time to take a coat, let alone take time out to bury the dead, to burn the equipment. At that point, they need military equipment instead of trying to destroy it, and so on. So, for these reasons, you have to allow for the 7 years to go no further than the midpoint of tribulation. And therefore, the invasion has to occur at least 3.5 years or more before the tribulation starts. All 7 years might happen before the tribulation, but no later than 3.5 years before the tribulation starts, the 7 years of burning equipment has to come to an end. And that's the only way to fit it in, is to put it in that pre-trib position.
Right. And then also the church, we're at a pre-trib rapture conference. Actually, to the listeners, we, Arnold and I, are it's December 8th, and we're in Dallas at the pre-trib rapture conference. So we also believe the rapture is a pre-trib event. And of course, we don't know exactly when that is, but do you see some hints in Ezekiel 38 and 39 where the church may not be here for that?
We might see it, we may not see it, we just don't know. Right. And those issues that God has chosen not to tell us which one comes first. We have, let's go back to 1947. At that point, we didn't know which would come first, Israel becoming a state, which was a pre-trib event, or the rapture. It turned out Israel came first. Then in 1966, we didn't know whether the rapture would come first or Israel would gain sovereignty over East Jerusalem. Well, Israel's sovereignty over Jerusalem came first. Well, same thing with the Ezekiel invasion. We don't know which one comes first. So maybe we'll be here for it, maybe not. Time will tell.
Right. And, of course, we're still here. These events happen. These are fulfillment of Bible prophecy. In 1948, the rebirth of the nation. 1967, taking over East Jerusalem, making it possible to consider rebuilding the temple. And the church is here to be able to use these as witnessing tools,
right,
fulfill Bible prophecy. And of course, we may be here to use Ezekiel 38 and 39 as even probably one of the greatest witnessing tools,
right,
because that there was so much detail given in those prophecies.
Right.
Is that correct? Okay. With that in mind, I believe Ezekiel 38 and 39, because of all the detail given, when that occurs, it will be very hard for anybody to think, if the church is still here, that replacement theology, it should put an end to replacement theology. Is that a fairly safe presumption?
Well, I think it will damper replacement theology for a while. It's like the rebirth of Israel dampened replacement theology for a while, and then it began to rise again, and then the Six-Day War came, it dampened again, and now it's been so many decades since the 60 was having a massive rise again. So I think that the Ezekiel invasion will dampen the replacement theology for a while, but I think Satan never stops working, and you've got even people within Christian circles that somehow want to become the new Israel and do away with the old Israel. Anti-Semitism still is found theologically as well as in other areas. So I have a hunch that Satan will find a way to cause it to rise again.
Well, and the reason this is important is because these powerful prophecies are finding fulfillment. The regathering of the Jews into the nation of Israel, to me, is a miracle of comparable, if not larger scale, than the parting of the Red Seas. And yet it's basically, although God's fingerprints are conspicuously all upon it, the Christian church, for the most part, doesn't even talk about it. Okay, now, Arnold, I want to ask you, presently, America seems to be turning its back on Israel. We're putting a lot of pressure on them, and to the point where it might seem that Netanyahu is buckling a little bit. He's moved forward to freeze, temporarily anyways, settlements and things like this. Now, this should create quite an uproar among some of his right-wing constituents over there. I think Israel's in a real quandary with America turning its back on them, Iran wanting to wipe them off the map, and the various geopolitical things I was talking about in the intro. What do you see happening there? How is this going to kind of maybe find some resolve?
Well, Netanyahu has to find some form of accommodation with the American government. And the new government is not anywhere near the pro-Israel. It was under Bush, and Bush was very pro-Israel. And Barack Obama is not. That's the basic fact. And so Israel has to do some accommodation. They'll never do all the accommodations that the government wants. And so he's agreed to cease all settlement building for 10 months, he's made two exceptions. Number one, East Jerusalem will continue. And number two, buildings in the West Bank that have begun will continue to be finished, but he won't start any new construction. And so basically he's given the Arabs 10 months to come back to negotiation tables, and for now they're still refusing to come. But they refuse to come. This was not under Netanyahu is going to make any more concessions. Maybe a subsequent government will. Again, we don't know. But under Netanyahu, he's going to be accommodating only so far, but no further. Because he's got his own frame of reference. He's not an extreme right winger, but he has the support of the extreme right wing. But he's more to the right than to the left himself. And therefore, he's not willing to give up too much. She's made a big concession, and now it's for the Arabs to respond, and if Obama doesn't apply his pressure to the Arabs either, then it's not going to go anywhere.
And they don't seem to be responding in
they're not responding.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's talk about this. Ezekiel 38 and 39, we've talked about this prophecy earlier, and, you know, Russian-Iranian relationships are extremely strong these days, as is other participants that we believe will be in that, like Libya and Turkey, strong relationships developing with Russia on some levels. So a lot of people are under the impression that that prophecy could find fulfillment in the very near future. I know you don't like to set dates and time on that, but I guess the question I have, and a little bit of the trouble I have with that, is that the Israel described in Ezekiel 38, which seems to be dwelling securely in the midst of the land, without walls, bars, or gates, apparently in very prosperous Israel, because that entices, that seems to be what Russia is coming after, is some of the wealth and spoil and whatnot. Do you believe Israel today meets that description?
Well, we know from the spoils of war comment is that Russia's motivation is not to enable help for the Arab peoples, but just coming home motivation. It doesn't specify the specifics of the spoils of war, but it's obviously some spoils of war for Russia's benefit. Only time will tell what that is. And how soon it's going to happen is something I refuse to get into. Mm-hmm. I am willing to go this far out on a limb. I want to say that we are closer today than we were yesterday. That's as close to a timetable as I give to anybody.
Right.
But the point is, it's a prophecy that has not been fulfilled in the past, therefore will be fulfilled in the future. How soon? Time will tell.
And a lot of people are, you know, recognizing, well, it does seem to be that Israel has to be the wealthy Israel that would entice Russia to come and coalesce with their coalition. So thus they're thinking maybe they'll discover oil, in something like Zion oil. They believe they've got some Old Testament references that maybe Israel, maybe there is oil under the soil of Israel. And of course they have found some natural gas deposits, large ones, right. Recently too. Any thoughts on that part of the equation?
Well, not necessarily be a natural resource. It could be just Russia found one thing to control the bridge between the continents of Africa, Asia, and Europe, which goes right to the land of Israel. Mm-hmm. And that might be sufficient spoils of war. She's got a warm ocean port. So there are other possibilities. So I think people have guessed in the past about finding oil, which has not been so far promising. They've also talked about the support, the wealth of the Dead Sea. So up until now, they haven't found an economic way to mine all that wealth except for the salt and so on. So again, we're guessing here. Mm-hmm. We know it's going to be spoils. So it'll be for Russia's own self-interest, but beyond that, time will tell what it'll be.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, if you look on a map of who Russia seems to put into their coalition, along the lines of what you're suggesting, we, you know, it could be as simple as they want to control that area and the commerce flowing in and out. A lot of these populations and countries do border major borders of water with Persia, you know, Iran now with the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea. It seems like through the Ethiopia down through Somalia and of course the Mediterranean with Libya and stuff like that. So that could be part of it, of the equation too. Like you said, we just don't know. Now, once upon a time, you and I had a lunch, and I'd mentioned that it's interesting to me that the nations that most closely border Israel today do not seem to be listed by Ezekiel in Ezekiel 38, although they are apparently listed in Psalm 83. And of course I contend, well, it's probably because Israel takes them out in Psalm 83. So I kind of jumped the gun on the timing of that being probably soon and next. Now, you had a pretty good argument in that it could simply be the different types of, you know, Persians versus Arabs and things like that. So what other potential alternative and might the reason be that those populations aren't inside of Ezekiel 38?
Well, if you look at the nations actually aligned, well, the Muslim countries aligned, none of them is an Arab country. Somalia is not an Arab country. Ethiopia is not an Arab country. Iran is Persian, not Arab. So these are, there are Muslim countries aligned with non-Muslim countries, but none of them are Arab countries. So the Arabs and the two protesting nations, Sheva and the Dan, are both non-Sarabian. They protest invasion, and they have what's going on. So the Arabs won't be too happy seeing the Russians there, so, because they recognize Russia's coming in with her own self-interest. She's not coming on behalf of the Arab population. And so no Arab country participates in it. The Bible does not deal with Islam as a religion because that's a post-biblical phenomenon. It does deal with the Arab peoples who are primarily Muslim. And it points out there'll be prophetically two major elements. Number one, there'll be destruction. Number two, there'll be conversion. So in the prophecies of Scripture, the lands of southern Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and southern Iraq all suffered total destruction with no inhabitants left. Whereas Egypt, central Jordan, northern Iraq, even Iran undergo national salvations, and they'll continue to exist into the Messianic Kingdom. And using even the Old Testament names, see Moab, Ammon, Elam, and so on, Assyria. And so there's going to see a massive turning of Arabs away from Islam to the God of Israel, and only then we'll probably have peace between Jews and Arabs.
Do you believe, some people are advocating that Islam is going to be a dominant factor, perhaps even the harlot of Revelation 17. That's sort of a new paradigm shift in thinking. Do you think there's any merit to that train of thought?
Again, the new paradigm shift is based upon current events, not based upon exegesis. Mm-hmm. What we see described in chapter 17 of Revelation is a one world religion of some kind, and no doubt it includes a collaboration formation of all world religions into one. No doubt Islam will be a part of it. Whether they're going to be dominant or not is a different issue. Only time will tell. They'll definitely be part of it, but as far as we can say biblically, they'll be a part of it, not necessarily dominant. Only time will tell if it's dominant.
Now, we know that in the aftermath of the rapture, there are going to be many people who come to know the Lord, and probably at the cost of their own life. What are some of the ways that they are going to come to know the Lord?
Well, many who probably heard the gospel before the rapture and didn't believe it, people will come believe it as a result of it. And while people are raptured, we also have to remember Bibles, the literature will not be taken away. Many people come to faith by what they read, more than what they've been told. So God will use different issues, what they remember from the past, reading Bible, reading gospel literature, and these all different ways. So you have some people coming, believers, and one from another, they begin to witness and win other people to the Lord. So God will use a variety of different factors, as he always has, and the same thing will happen in the future.
And then, of course, we have rolling in, it would be the 144,000 witnesses.
Right.
What's their role?
Their role is to serve as God's evangelists for the first half of the tribulation. They conduct a worldwide preaching campaign. They'll bring about a worldwide revival in a short period of time, 3.5 years. The result of their preaching is, he points out in Revelation 7, verses 9 to 17, there'll be Gentiles saved in every nation, every tribe, every language group. So we'll see a massive revival for the first time, which will be worldwide. Historically, we've had national revivals, we've had regional revivals, but now they had a worldwide revival. We'll see that. And as a result, 144,000.
And is that why I've heard you in the past suggest that among these 144,000, they are still, some of them, many distributed in different Gentile nations and things presently, perhaps?
Right. In fact, the first three verses of Revelation 7 point out that they come from the four winds. Nothing about 144 Jews all coming from Israel. He these 144,000 Jews God will select from different parts of the world. So everybody speaks the languages necessary, and many Jews are multilingual outside the U.S. And so from all over the world, they'll come to faith and be able to get the gospel around very quickly.
And then, of course, the two witnesses of Revelation 11, what is their role? What's the significance of that?
They have ministries at the same time, 144,000, but they're geographically limited to Jerusalem. So our ministry is to the Jewish people from the beginning to midpoint of tribulation when they are killed. So 144,000 have a worldwide ministry, primarily the Gentile world. The two witnesses have a geographically limited ministry, primarily the Jewish world. Though it's obvious that they affect the world in general, they're primarily focused on Jerusalem.
And because they seem to simulate powers or demonstrate powers that were similar to Elijah and Moses, many people suggest it could be Elijah and Moses. What's your thoughts on that?
It's been interesting how many people have tried to identify the two witnesses with some historical characters, which they don't do anybody else in the Revelation. Everything else in Revelation is future except for those two beings. And nothing in the text implies the historical characters. And if they were historical personnel, I'm sure that they would have listed the Moses and Elijah, or Enoch and Elijah, some believe, and so on. So I think it's wiser to interpret them as being two people living at that point of time, two Jewish men living at that point of time that God was like for that purpose. There's no reason to make them Elijah, Moses, Enoch. Elijah is indeed coming back, but he's not coming back to be among the two witnesses, because when Elijah appears in the Mount of Transfiguration, the Luke 9 account, he appears with Jesus in glory. And you have a glorified state, you can't die. So, and when the two witnesses die, Elijah cannot be one of them. So yes, Elijah's coming back, but no, he's not one of the two witnesses.
That's a good point. The seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments of Revelation, do you believe they all come during the tribulation period?
Yes, I think the first seal begins the war of the tribulation, and the seven seals and the seven trumpets occur in the first half, and the seven bowls happen towards the latter part of the second half.
Okay, very good. Arnold, I want to shift gears a little bit here, and I want to talk about the Antichrist. First of all, do you think he could possibly be on the scene today?
Again, he might be. Again, we don't know. At this point of time, depends how fast the events will proceed. He may already have been born, waiting to rise to power, or he may not be born as yet. Every time we have new elections, I get the same question: could this person be the Antichrist? I'm amazed how many people think the Antichrist has to be American, and even Ronald Reagan, because his first, middle, and last name all have six letters to them. Therefore, he must be the Antichrist, as if God is impressed with the Latin alphabet that we use in English. And then the same thing happened with Kissinger, and then other examples. And now the same thing with Barack Obama. So they asked me, could he be the Antichrist? So I simply say, well, maybe he'll fulfill the prophecy about the Obama nation of desolation. Not likely. But the Antichrist would be supernaturally conceived by the power of Satan through a woman that will be of Roman origin, and he will rise to power, and eventually he'll focus on worshipping his father Satan, and Satan will offer him the same offer he offered to Jesus, and Jesus rejected the offer, and Satan will accept it, and the Antichrist will accept it, and that's how he will begin to rule the kingdoms of the world throughout the world. So he'll begin his rise to power before the tribulation. He'll sign the covenant with Israel that will trigger the tribulation. He will be contemporary with the other kings for the first half of the tribulation. At the midpoint, he kills three of them. The other seven submit to him. And then for the second half of the tribulation, he'll be the one world ruler and rule for 42 months, Revelation says, or 3.5 years.
So Let me see if I got this correct. You believe the 10 kings will surface in the first half of the tribulation, or they'll be going into that?
They'll surface before the tribulation starts, and will surface into tribulation.
Okay.
Because you have the 10 kings first, and after them arise the little horn. Mm-hmm. The tribulation begins when the little horn signs the 7-year covenant, And so he signs it as guaranteeing Israel's military security. And so then he has to eventually share power until the midpoint. To the midpoint, he will begin this world takeover through satanic power.
Okay. Now, there are two kings in Daniel 11:41, I believe it is, that basically seem to be defeated by the Antichrist or submit to the Antichrist on some level. I'm not clear on exactly how the Hebrew word reads on that. It almost, you know, a lot of commentaries say they're destroyed, but some seem to think they're humbled, or from the Hebrew word. So
actually, there are three kings of that chapter 11, the king of the north, south, and east. And building on Daniel 7, Daniel 11 is pointing out the three kings he kills is the king of the south, which is Egypt, king of the north, which is Syria, and the king of the east, which is Mesopotamia. Those are three kings he will kill before he takes over the world.
Okay, so yeah, you believe that that does talk about the specific, at least two or three kings that do submit to him,
right,
that fall. Now, this you'd mentioned the Antichrist is of Roman origin. Now, the there's a paradigm shift out there that. And you say that because of Daniel 9:26, correct? He will come from the people who destroyed
right.
the city and the sanctuary of the Roman Empire.
Right.
Now, there are those out there who are advocating that Roman Legion 10 Fretentius was, although it was under Roman command, it was mainly made up of Syrian and Assyrian mercenaries and things like that. That, you know, that was sort of a tendency with the Roman Empire. They would come along and capture an area and then put those populations into their army, into the service of their army. So I've had a little trouble with this paradigm shift and them suggesting that it really technically wasn't the Roman legion that did this sort of thing, and therefore it's not out of context to think that this could be an Assyrian Antichrist rather than a Roman Antichrist. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I knew with Daniel's four prophecies from the beginning, chapter 2, he deals with four Gentile empires. He was specifying in chapter 7 and chapter 11 and so on, Antichrist is the final ruler of the four Gentile empire. But the four Gentile empire represents what was begun with Rome. And so he talks about them as empires, as far as kingdoms, and not necessarily different ethnic elements that might be within the Roman army. Regardless of all these armies had different ethnic elements, the Babylonian army and others had different ethnic elements. There was the Babylonian army, there was the Medo-Persian army, there was the Hellenistic army, and there was the Roman army. And so the focus of Daniel is not on one ethnic element of a contingency, but the focus is on specifically the Roman army responsible for destroying the temple. And I do not see the evidence that only that one ethnic group was involved in Jerusalem's destruction. The Roman army even there was made up of more than one group, including Italian groups and so on. So again, that argument is the new paradigm shift is again based upon current events, not based upon exegeting the word. So after Daniel's context of dealing with four Gentile empires, and this is part of the fourth empire, yet the Christ has to be of the same ethnic identity as the government that destroys the city temple. That was the Roman army, and not specifically any ethnic group apart from it.
Yeah, and lots of times they'll point to the Antichrist being an Assyrian. They'll go to Micah 5. And, you know, I think if you study it closely, it does talking about an Assyrian ruler, leader, but I'm not exactly sure it's talking about the Antichrist per se. Have you looked at that under
yes.
that litmus test?
I think it most likely is not referring to the Antichrist, but referring to, in Micah's prophecies in chapter 1, on Sennacherib's invasion.
Right.
And so I'll be more focused on Sennacherib. But let's assume it's a future one. That might indicate that the Antichrist himself will be born in what is now what was ancient Assyria, now northern Iraq. But his ethnic identity through his bloodline has to go back to Rome.
Okay.
But I really don't think it's an Antichrist prophecy.
And then, of course, that segues into the thought, well, then he might be a Muslim, because general people from that area are Islamic right now. Where do you go to that?
But those who call themselves Assyrians today are not Muslims. the Assyrian population in Iraq, it's a very small population, it's located in Iraq and also Syria, are the ones who are direct descendants of ancient Assyrians, which are not Arab. Mm-hmm. They were not Arab. Mm-hmm. The Arab population, as a result of the Arab conquests in the 7th century, just like the Coptics today are the actual descendants of ancient Egyptians, but most of the Egyptians are there Arab, mm-hmm. because of the Arab conquest. Mm-hmm. So they're called Egypt. Only the Coptics are true of the Egyptian line, and the Assyrian community, which is a Christian community, is of the ancient Assyrian line. So again, the term Assyrian technically will refer to that line more than to the Arab population there. So again, trying to make him an Arab Muslim, I think is foolish exegetically. But on top of that, the Antichrist, Israel makes him a kind of Antichrist because he guarantees Israel's military security. And that's what the Israelis put their trust in. No Israeli leader, whether he's right wing or left wing, will ever trust any Muslim Arab to guarantee Israel's military security. That's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's, no matter how liberal the Israeli leadership may be, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so they just ignore these kinds of issues.
Well, and it says in Daniel that he will exalt himself above all that is called God, correct? And
yes.
I can't imagine a Muslim exalting himself above Allah.
That's called God, sure.
So I think there's a couple arguments in that direction. Speaking of Assyria, Assyria is a participant in Psalm 83, verses 6 through 8. And I notice in Footsteps of Messiah, and I tend to agree with you, that you list that as being, one of the members as being Syria, perhaps modern-day Syria, but you also caveat it's also northern Iraq.
Let's say mostly northern Iraq,
okay.
With certain segments of what is now eastern Assyria.
Okay.
Again, the borders were not always the same.
Right.
So Syria was distinct from Assyria, and the actual name in biblical Hebrew was Aramea, not Syria.
Right.
But what is now on the borderline between Assyria and Iraq used to be part of ancient Assyria.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just go back to the way the borders used to be, I wouldn't equate Assyria with Syria. It's primarily northern Iraq, but with certain segments of eastern Assyria, which is eastern Syria.
Yeah, and it seems to be that the time Asaph wrote the psalm about 3,000 years ago, the Assyria had conquered the Hittites into part of northeastern modern-day Syria,
yeah.
But it's still there was still a distinction between Aram or Aramea, like you say, and Ashur, which
right.
was the old Assyrian
right.
word. So, you know, technically, really, was it incorporating modern-day Syria? At one point in time, that empire seemed to stretch down further into Aram and things like that. But at the time Asaph wrote, I don't believe that was the case. And the reason that's interesting is because there's another prophecy that definitely does involve Syria, and that would be Damascus in Isaiah 17:1. So I have thought to incorporate Isaiah 17:1, the destruction of Damascus, it will cease to be a city, it will be a ruinous heap, into the Psalm 83 equation. However, it may be totally independent. What's your thoughts on that?
Which country now?
Isaiah 17:1,
right.
Damascus will cease to be a city. Damascus would have generally been in Aram or Aramea, Syria. So do you think that could be part of the Psalm 83 scenario?
Could be. Again, I'm not sure when that's going to be. Damascus was used to be a city. Whether it happens before the tribulation or in the tribulation, again, only time will tell.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's part of the Psalm 83 situation, it could happen before the tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it does not happen in the tribulation. Normally, something in the tribulation is spelled out in the day of the Lord. You don't find that phrase in that chapter, which means it might either happen before the tribulation or in it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think about with, when it comes to Psalm 83 is, I agree with you, I believe that God is going to empower the Israeli military, the Israeli defense forces, should it occur while they exist today, to do battle, curse for curse in kind. This confederacy wants to destroy Israel. Israel destroys them. Asaph petitions in Psalm 83 verses 9 through 11. And the petition takes us back to Judges 4 through 8, when Gideon went against the Midianites, and Ehud Barak with the prophetess Deborah went against King Jabin and whatnot. And these were populations that oppressed Israel. But then when they were defeated, empowered militarily, Gideon was empowered by God and whatnot, they ceased, to my knowledge, to ever oppress Israel again. Is that correct? Did these people ever come back to oppress Israel, to your knowledge?
The same people coming back?
Yeah, like the Midianites. I don't recall finding them again oppressing Israel.
They're not mentioned again.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're playing a future role.
So my thought is Asaph is saying, petitioning God to say, look, much like that, empower the Israeli military so that once and for all they're taken out of the equation so they can never oppress us again.
Okay.
I think is what he's trying to suggest there. And so therefore, and I also connect Ezekiel 25:14 and Obadiah 1:18 and some other passages whereby it does look like the Israeli military is involved in conquesting over the Psalm 83 Confederacy. That's how God seems to deal with that. And if there is a covenant confirmed with Israel that creates a 3.5-year period of peace in the tribulation, it doesn't appear like that Israeli military is active, per se, during that first 3.5 years. Is that a safe presumption?
Well, the purpose of the covenant is not so much a peace covenant as much as guaranteeing Israel's military security. So if the military security is secured, then that they wouldn't need an army to be too active. So probably the army probably see a lot of its activity, which is probably why when the abomination occurs, the Jews immediately flee the land. The army's not ready to tackle it.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying right, then the first 3.5 years, it's unlikely that they would be defeating the Psalm 83 Arab Confederates. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. And then I take it and I think, well, in the second 3.5, they're sort of fleeing for their lives.
Exactly.
So I find it a little difficult to try to see where that's going to fit in the 7-year tribulation period.
No, it's a much better thing has been pre-trib already.
Okay, Arnold, I want to thank you so much for being on the program. We've discussed a lot of prophecies, and as I was hoping, we've had Israel in the center of that, which is, I think, is very important for Christians to know more about Israel and what we're really grafted into as Gentiles and into the promises that God gave to Abraham.